Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're going to step back decades in a brief amount of time, step back more than decades into the founding of our country to talk about presidents and when they go abroad and to what end. Presidents and foreign visits in historical context. Today, joining us, Tim Walch, Director Emeritus of Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
Jim McCormick is with us, a professor of political science at Iowa State University, of course, heard most often on our Politics Wednesday. Jim, off-site, off ISU's site, to be specific, joining us by phone today. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
I just want to mention that the seed for this this hour is President Trump's visit to North Korea late last month, late June 30th, or on June 30th, he became the first U.S. president to cross the demilitarized zone into North Korea. Jim, perhaps you can tell us the significance of doing that and why no president since the Korean War or before the Korean War has done that.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened at the end of World War II was to divide up the Korean Peninsula. And basically it was divided up because of the occupation forces in the south. American and Western forces were there, and in the north it was Russian-controlled. And, you know, there was the declaration, I think, in, 1948 of the independence of both of those, or the sovereignty of both of those countries. And so the United States was not content to allow the North simply be taken over by the communists.
Mm-hmm. And so President Trump stepping through that demilitarized zone and really nothing planned. It was not a long planned action, was it, Jim? Just gave notice that this is something he wanted to do.
Yes, apparently there was a tweet a few, really 24 hours, I guess, to the North. But there was at least a statement that that President Trump was talking about it for 3 or 4 days as part of his visit. But it was not a planned kind of visit that we normally see when presidents go abroad to talk to foreign dignitaries. They usually have a fair bit of preparation. They have some advance teams. And they really are in a position to figure out exactly what they're going to accomplish during the visit. This was not. This was all spontaneity.
Mm-hmm. And critics of the president calling this a mere photo opportunity, all show and no substance, we'll see as relations with North Korea and the future of their nuclear arsenal develop. Let's go back further in history with you, Tim Walch. What are the earliest instances of U.S. presidents traveling abroad?
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, I think most people would be surprised that no presidents of the United States in the 18th or 19th century left our shores to visit other countries. It just was not done. Now, partly it's an issue of travel because you're traveling by ship and it just takes a long time to do that. So the first president to leave our shores as president, now several of them after their presidency did visit Europe and so forth, but mm-hmm. as president would be Theodore Roosevelt, who went down to Panama after the independence of Panama and the beginning of the Panama construction for the canal to kind of inspect the canal. TR was a very hands-on president, so I don't think that comes as a surprise. And then after TR, Taft, I think, visited Panama and elsewhere as a former president. And then the most significant foreign trip, and really marking the beginning of our role as a world power and a world leader, was Woodrow Wilson, who, of course, after World War I, to make the world safe for democracy, spent 7 months in Europe as part of the Paris Peace Treaty, a peace
conference.
Seven months. There was a break in there, but cumulatively 7 months overseas, basically hammering out the League of Nations in the terms of the surrender and realigning the nations of Europe and Africa. So it was a Herculean task for which Wilson got the Nobel Peace Prize. So it was a significant investment, both of his time, but also of work product. And as Jim suggests, I mean, a handshake or a purpose for most visits is to come up with some sort of a treaty or a conference, some sort of resolution. It's not general. It's a working event. So shaking a hand or say visiting the Queen of England, although nice and symbolic, and there are those aspects to these visits, really the intent, if you look back in history, is let's find a way to resolve our differences or come up with some sort of an agreement. Mm-hmm. And so after Wilson, really the most Herbert Hoover, by the way, never left the country while president. For a man who traveled as much as Herbert Hoover did, it's interesting to note that as president, he stayed here in the United States.
And he was incredibly engaged internationally in the famine in Europe and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. During all those years before his presidency, engaged in saving Belgium and in Russia and so many other activities, but not as president. When Franklin Roosevelt becomes president, it's not really until the dawn of World War II where it became a necessity for him to meet first with Winston Churchill in the Atlantic on a ship to hammer out the Atlantic Charter, which becomes the sort of blueprint for the United Nations and basically coordinating Britain and the United States in terms of fighting the war. And then he met subsequently in Casablanca and then in Tehran and eventually into Yalta to work with the other allies, with Great Britain and with Russia, to determine when and where we would attack the Nazis.
Well, let's step back in time. Here's some archive audio from February of 1945. If you have your World War II
That's
history
Yalta,
in mind,
probably yes.
This is Yalta, February 1945. The capitulation, the declaration of
the end of the war.
The end of the war would come just a few months after Yalta. The Big Three, as they were known: Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union, met in Yalta, Russia, to discuss the reorganization of post-war Europe. I guess some would say divided up. Here's a little bit of audio from a British newsreel of the time.
The three great leaders and their staffs of military and political advisors face the inevitable battery of cameras. Through 5.5 years of war, we have long awaited this moment of the Churchill-Roosevelt-Stalin meeting, the Grand Alliance. At this point in our history, we know that Germany is to go into a straitjacket of Allied imposed discipline. The blueprint of its future has been drawn, signed, and sealed. Let a quotation from the communique issued from Yalta speak for us all. It is our inflexible purpose to destroy German militarism and Nazism and ensure that Germany will never again be able to disturb the peace of the world.
From February of 1945, a newsreel, Jim McCormick there. We are on the eve, but you can tell by the voicing, the proud exclamation in this newsreel, we are not in the Cold War yet.
No, not at all. The hope was, at least certainly Roosevelt's hope was, that there would be, as there had been cooperation in war with the Soviet Union, there would also be cooperation in peace afterwards. And certainly that was kind of his ideal. I mean, he talks about setting up really kind of a balance of power system, among the major powers here. And certainly even the UN Charter, in which, the veto power is given to the permanent kind of members. In some ways, those major members were to be kind of the source of managing the global system after the war. So there really was the expectation, at least on the part of Roosevelt, that there could be cooperation. Now, it turns out that some of his advisors were very suspicious of Stalin and of the Soviet Union, and there was already, and certainly by the time that Truman took over after Roosevelt's death, there was increasing suspicion among some of Truman's advisors about really trying to continue to cooperate. And Truman has that famous statement that he was supposedly told the Soviets to live up to your agreements and you'll get along with us. But that was certainly a short-lived kind of effort here.
Tim Walz. Yeah,
Jim is absolutely right. And, of course, in February of 1945, FDR's health was in decline. Now, we know a lot more about it after the fact than we did at the time. And Churchill was worried about Roosevelt and worried about Stalin, didn't trust Stalin as well. And as Jim suggests, the president's advisors were cautiously concerned about that. Roosevelt dies in April. So only a few months later, he comes back. He's ill. He continues to decline. He was extremely hopeful and optimistic about the future of the world under Stalin. Not so with Winston Churchill. Churchill is voted out of office, too, I think, in that summer. And so it's Potsdam in Germany that Truman is first to meet Stalin, along with, I think, Clement Attlee.
Potsdam, the post-war.
I think it's in September of that year. And, of course, it's got to be July, because Truman goes and in a casual way lets Stalin know, oh, by the way, we have this bomb that may end the war a little sooner. And, of course, Stalin's eyebrows go up, apparently, as if, oh, that's interesting. And apparently he may have known already about the atomic bomb that was coming, because very soon after the dropping, of the second bomb on Nagasaki, the Russians began to move against Japan. So you have these sort of jockeying, this game of chess going on among and between world leaders. And although we didn't know in 45 that the Cold War was coming, when you look back on it, you can see the threads going forward.
Right. And so often with these events, and we'll talk about others that have this in common, Tim, that at the time, it's hard to see what they will come to mean in historical context. Yalta being an example.
Well, and people say, for example, the attack on Pearl Harbor. Oh, the president must have known. There's all this evidence that something was going to happen. Well, there's a lot of chatter that goes on in real time, and trying to see the bright red lines or the needles in the haystack, whatever metaphor you want to use, can be difficult. And we can look back. One of the benefits of being an historian is you can look back and be almost omniscient and see how the path forward. And that's the lure of history.
Tim Walz is with us, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Jim McCormick joining us by phone, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. This hour, we're talking about presidents and foreign visits throughout history. The most significant ones you're hearing some audio from, recounting the setting, taking us back to that time. Let's go from Yalta, the immediate post-war, post-World War II period to progress. We don't have a cut of it, but the famous speech from Winston Churchill of the Iron Curtain descending, that speech given
Westminster
right here.
Westminster College, Fulton, I think it's Fulton, Missouri.
Missouri, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And let's go a little bit further in time to 1963, in June of 1963, that famous speech in Berlin by John Kennedy. Jim, let me turn to you to set this up and tell us where we were in 1963 that prompted then President Kennedy to make that trip and to make that amazing, arguably the most significant Cold War speech.
Well, what happened in August of 1961 was sort of pivotal when suddenly, there had been the movement of East Germans or East Berliners into West Berlin, and suddenly the East German government, with Soviet support, set up this wall, put these bricks and mortar and so on. And so they divided the city of Berlin here with this really concrete wall, and it became in some ways the real symbol of the barrier between East and West. Now there's a longer story, because in 1958 there was a Berlin crisis. There was again one in 1961, in which the East German governor, really the Soviets, had cut off access to Berlin, which of course was located at that time in East German territory here. And so there had been an agreement going back to 1949 and even 1971 and allowing access. But there had been this kind of cutoff by the Soviets to Berlin. And then the wall became, in some ways, really the symbol of the division of not only Germany, but division of Europe here. And so Kennedy was actually criticized early on, and maybe Tim can fill in more on this, for not responding more quickly because the building of the wall took the West a little bit by surprise here in August of 1961. And so part of it was Kennedy going to Berlin and making this famous statement that I am a Berliner, ich bin ein Berliner, you know, really was the symbol that the United States and the West was going to support Berlin and more broadly Germany and even more broadly in terms of Europe. So it was, if you think of it in terms of the present concern about whether the United States will support its allies and so on, this is really a tangible indicator of the kind of support that the United States would give where the American president goes. And I took the liberty last night to read the whole speech. And it really is quite a profound speech. It's a relatively short speech, but it's really quite moving in terms of what he says. If there's any doubt about, you know, the challenge that the communist world presents, let them come to Berlin. And he has a number of cadences like that in the speech, which really gives the impression of the kind of deep concern that Kennedy expressed. But in some ways, it was also a response, in my view, to Kennedy not responding early enough in 1961 and meeting some immediate criticism for not having a sort of a response.
Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks for that comment from Tim Walsh in just a moment. But first, we're talking about this momentous speech. Let's hear a couple of excerpts. Jim, that's impressive. You read the speech last night in preparation. Let's go back to June 26, 1963, President John F. Kennedy, one of the most famous speeches of his presidency in Berlin, Kennedy addressing an audience of nearly a half million West Berliners, denouncing communism and his promise to bring peace to Europe and Germany. Let's hear an excerpt.
What is true of this city is true of Germany. Real lasting peace in Europe can never be assured as long as one German out of four is denied the elementary right of free men, and that is to make a free choice. In 18 years of peace and good faith, this generation of Germans has earned the right to be free, including the right to unite their families and their nation in lasting peace with goodwill to all people.
Okay, and let's go to a second excerpt from that same speech in June of 1963. The line that Jim mentioned that everyone remembers when JFK showed his solidarity with the people of Berlin, uttering arguably the most famous words of the Cold War, the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was Civis Romanus Sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is Ich bin ein Berliner. I appreciate my interpreter translating my German.
Kennedy's humor coming through there, recognizing his Boston accent.
That's right.
Came through in his German. Talk about
a little ragged. Well, what was interesting is as he flew into to Berlin, he saw these massive crowds and he realized he needed to kind of bump up the power of the prose. And he and Ted Sorensen, his speechwriter, worked on that. And so they basically added that to the speech. The come to Berlin, which he repeats over and over in the speech. speech. It's 9 minutes long, so it's not very long, as Jim suggests, was very much a part of it. But Ich bin ein Berliner was something that he wrote down and wrote it down phonetically to try to get it as polished as he could with his Boston accent. But they understood the power of the words, and if there's anything that Kennedy leaves us as a legacy of his presidency is the ability, along with Ted Sorensen, to have words soar above and to embrace the meaning that we are with you. And in some ways, as historians, we look back and we can see the threads of the power of that speech in the disastrous meeting he had with Khrushchev in 1961. He's a young president. Khrushchev is a seasoned communist leader. He's going to push this young dilettante president, and it just did not go well. And so the wall goes up in 63 rather suddenly, and Kennedy feels he's got to make a statement against what Khrushchev and the Russians represent in East Germany, and that's, you know, the evolution of the Cold War. We've talked about this. That wall, and when it comes down in 89, is such a symbol of the division of Europe at the time in the 60s that, of course, when they began to break the wall down into pieces, they were shipping it all over the world. Every presidential library now has a section of the wall. It's not always in great shape. And many of the gift shops at these our presidential libraries had these cardboard boxes with a little piece of the wall, authentic piece of the Berlin Wall purchased at the Hoover Library or whatever, because the wall came down, the Cold War was over in 89, and so forth. But it starts with Ich bin ein Berliner.
Jim, we have just a minute or so before we go to break, but a message for the West Berliners there, but also this speech, a strong signal to the Soviet government as well here. Quickly, we have just like 30 seconds.
Yes, it really was. I mean, because the actual, in the speech itself, Kennedy makes reference to East Berliners and to East Germany, you know, that he's also speaking in some ways to them, he said. So it really resonated not just with West Berliners and with the West, but it also resonated considerably with East Berliners as well and East Germany and really beyond to the Soviet Union.
Okay, we'll be back after a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the fall of the Berlin Wall, presaged, I suppose you could say, by Ronald Reagan. We'll hear something from that speech. Also, Nixon in China, 1972, a week-long visit to China, thought to be unthinkable before it happened. It went down in history as such a moment that this opera was developed. Nixon in China. Let's hear a little bit about this opera that marks how the walls that divided the U.S. and China came down. We'll be back in just a minute. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Your flight was smooth, I hope. Oh, yes, smoother than usual, I guess. Yes, it was very pleasant. We stopped in Hawaii for a day, and Guam to catch up on the time. It's easier that way. The Prime Minister knows about that. He is such a traveler. No, not I. But as a traveler, come home for good to China. One for whom all travel is a penance now.
We'll explore Nixon in China. Take us back. Tim Walsh with Jim McCormick. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Tim Walsh, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, presidential historian, along with Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. It's not a Politics Wednesday. We're looking back at presidents and their foreign visits in history, when these foreign visits became practical through travel that didn't take days and days to get from one side of the Atlantic to the other, for instance. Still to come, we'll talk about the momentous visit of Richard Nixon to China in the early 70s, also Obama in Cuba. We want to finish up a few things. Last half hour, if you've just joined us, we were talking about the building of the Berlin Wall, the famous JFK speech where he denounced communism and also said in solidarity with the West Berliners, we are with you here in the West. Let's finish up there. We started talking about the demise of the Berlin Wall. Let me play a bit of President Reagan in Berlin, June 12, 1987, at the Brandenburg Gate in West Berlin. President Ronald Reagan gave a speech calling for the then Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to do away with this despised Berlin Wall. Let's listen to Ronald Reagan.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
So those words arguably mark the end. Some historians, yeah. Tim, say this is the end of the Cold War.
Well, December of 89 is when the Cold War in effect ends.
The beginning of the end.
Beginning of the end, yeah. Perestroika and so forth. And, of course, it's not as if Reagan had not met already with Gorbachev. He had met with Gorbachev, I think, a couple of times before that. And he was getting to know Gorbachev. The two of them really are kind of circling one another, trying to decide how they can work out agreements on things as, you know, fundamental as the relations in Europe, but also things like the intermediate nuclear test ban treaties and so forth. You know, it was an important speech. And again, much like Kennedy and Sorensen, Reagan had that ability to work with his speechwriters. And I think that's Peggy Noonan, but I can't be quite sure. That ability to come up with a phrase that imprints itself on the American mind. So I am a Berliner. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, shows fundamental resolve on the part of the American people.
Mm-hmm. More than 2 years before the wall did eventually come down. I remember this because I was in my mid-20s, having just moved to Germany at the time this speech by Ronald Reagan was made. And I can only say in reflecting on it that it struck me and others, Germans I was in contact with, as completely unrealistic and fanciful to call for this what had become a permanent, it seemed, part of the landscape. Jim McCormick, your thoughts.
It really had become permanent and part of the landscape as you described it there. And so it was really quite remarkable. You know, the date is sort of memorable to me. It's November 9th, 1989. And I remember watching on television and staying up late, actually, as people were breaching the wall and up on top of the wall and clapping and moving back and forth. I mean, it was really a monumental kind of event that occurred, and it was so remarkable because it had been such a fixture since the 1960s as really the factor that had demarcated the world or divided the world between East and West. And suddenly, really almost spontaneously, it seemed in retrospect, it was breached and people were dancing on it as Tim was saying, some taking souvenirs from it, and now it's ended up in, you know, in various libraries and so on. But it was really indescribable in terms of the kind of euphoria that took place on that particular night.
So the question here is, Reagan making this speech more than 2 years before the actual breach of the Berlin Wall in 89, Did Reagan's speech, do you think, Tim Walz, have something to do with this? Can rhetoric break down walls?
I think we're seeing the Cold War thaw in many different threads. I think the election of a Polish pope and his visit to back to Poland had some effect on it. I think Romanian resistance to Ceausescu, because he was, I think, thrown out of office by the end of December of 89. I think Gorbachev and Perestroika and his work with Reagan, all of these things contributed to the end of the war. The wall became the symbol. And once the wall began to come down, as Jim suggests, I think it really registered with the American people. And I, too, remember them breaking the wall. And I also remember Ceausescu's arrest and assassination. Again, it was just it's hard to think all of a sudden in a period of about 4 or 5 weeks, nations were right. changing governments very quickly. And all of a sudden, the communists, who we thought would be there forever, you know, much like landing a man on the moon, which, of course, is 50 years ago this month, the fall of Eastern Europe just didn't seem possible.
Well, and it did seem like dominoes falling.
Oh.
In November 9th,
yeah.
I was in Berlin to watch the Berlin Wall fall and report
Where
on it.
Where were you? Oh.
And then I returned to Cologne, where I lived at the time. And then we saw this unrest is not over,
no.
this peaceful revolution. And the joke was, well, which revolution do we go to next? As it turned out, we went to the Velvet Spring. We went to
Havel?
To Prague,
yeah.
yes.
Okay.
Václav Havel. And so it was, just
yeah.
as you gentlemen describe, a series of events that had a momentum to it.
But the fact that we remember these things now, that Jim and I remember these things, much like other events, like the Kennedy speech or the Reagan speech, that we mark our past by specific memories of events that took place in our past, and they become iconic, much like Nixon in China becomes an opera. And as I mentioned, Yale Repertory Theater has done A Walk in the Woods between Gorbachev and Reagan as a play, and it becomes, you know, woven into our culture.
Presidential history.
It also being significant that Gorbachev decided not to use force.
Yes.
You know, they sort of opened up the
point.
Floodgate
yeah.
for people to leave the East
yeah.
and to let these changes happen. I think that was very, very consequential
right.
as well. On the other side, what's often talked about is, you know, George H.W. Bush
Excellent
was president
point.
At the time. And, you know, he made this famous statement that, you know, there was going to be no gloating over the collapse of the Berlin Wall or the kind of changes that were going on. He said he was an observer, you know, and not really going to be a sort of a participant. So there was not the kind of hoopla, if you will, that maybe a different American president could have made that might have changed the environment, because that led, of course, very quickly to the reunification of Germany. I mean, in retrospect, it was within 1 year, even less than 1 year, that Germany was reunified.
And then building on that, the enlargement of NATO and
sure.
the enlargement of the EU
right.
And so forth. Let me remind our listeners who've just joined us. Jim McCormick is with us of Iowa State University, longtime political science professor there. Tim Walz, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. We have a couple more. We're talking about presidents and their foreign visits, a couple of significant ones yet to get to before this hour ends. We've talked about Richard Nixon in China. Let's delve into that a little bit more. During Nixon's week-long visit to China in February of 1972, he visited the Great Wall of China. He spoke about how he hoped his visit would bring down the walls that divided the U.S. and China. Let's listen to a few of his words from 1972.
And one stands there and sees the wall going to the peak of this mountain, and I think that you would have to conclude that this is a great wall and that it had to be built by a great people. I think one of the results of our trip, we hope, may be that the walls that are erected, whether they are physical walls like this or whether they are other walls of ideology or philosophy, will not divide peoples in the world, that peoples, regardless of their differences in backgrounds and their philosophies, will have an opportunity to communicate with each other, to know each other, and to share with each other those particular endeavors that will mean peaceful progress in the years ahead.
President Richard Nixon in 1972 in China. Remind us, Tim Walz, what made this so significant?
Well, first of all, Richard Nixon built his political reputation on being a staunch anti-communist, including questioning who lost China, because, of course, we had supported Chiang Kai-shek and the Republic of China for many, many years. And in fact, we resisted the recognition of the People's Republic of China as the UN representative of the Chinese people, even though, in effect, they controlled the mainland and the Republic of China was nothing more than the island of Taiwan. So Richard Nixon, the thought that Richard Nixon would establish a rapport with Chou Enlai and Mao Zedong seemed almost impossible. And again, like the Berlin Wall coming down, it was one of those events that surprised and shocked. It showed an extraordinary confidence on Nixon's part. But I also think he was bolstered by Henry Kissinger, who spent at least two visits in anticipation of Nixon going to China, laying the groundwork. The Chinese were ready to open to the Western world and to the United States. And Nixon saw this as a way to sort of bolster his foreign policy credentials, and supported by Kissinger, it was enormously successful. There's you could hardly argue that there's anything more successful than that in the Nixon presidency.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, because Nixon was such a staunch anti-communist, did that work to his advantage in this case?
Yes, I think it did. I mean, that he would not be seen as somebody that would make concessions to communism, or to, in this case, the Chinese communists. And so that he could go there and make any kind of accommodation that he would without suffering repercussions back at home because he was, say, soft on communism. You know, ironically, of course, which as Tim noted, was what he had, you know, talked about the State Department and, you know, the whole loss of China. And that was, identifying some individuals or this sort of whole McCarthy era as some individuals soft on communism. So he could do this without the kind of political consequences at home and even abroad because of his kind of reputation that he had.
Mm-hmm. And yet China began its opening in 1972, but we've had many decades in the meantime. It's opened in a much different sense in the more recent years, Tim.
Oh, I mean, there's no question that first of all, it was a slow process. Yes, he visited in 72, and they worked out kind of protocols for the recognition of China. It was not, I think, formalization of relations was not until the Carter years, I think, in 79. And you can see the evolving change in China. They didn't necessarily abandon communism, but with the death of Mao and the passing of Chou Enlai and Deng Xiaoping emerging and the whole idea of kind of communism and capitalism simultaneously developing China into this great world power with this kind of coming together and again embracing the notion that China is the one great nation next to heaven is China.
You know? Mm-hmm. As we finish up this hour, let's zoom to very recent history, 2016 history, as a matter of fact. President Barack Obama becoming the first president since Calvin Coolidge to visit Cuba in March of 2016. Now, if we take ourselves back to this time, the U.S. and Cuba did not see eye to eye on many issues. But the purpose of this trip, as explained according to President Obama, was to help improve relations between the two countries and lift the trade embargo.
Now, for more than half a century, the sight of a U.S. president here in Havana would have been unimaginable. But this is a new day. Es un nuevo día between our two countries. I bring with me the greetings and the friendship of the American people. In fact, I'm joined on this trip by nearly 40 members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans. This is the largest such delegation of my presidency, and it indicates the excitement and interest in America about the process that we've undertaken. These members of Congress recognize that our new relationship with the Cuban people is in the interest of both nations.
Jim McCormick, your thoughts, especially when we consider today how that rollback of the opening to Cuba has been accomplished by President Trump.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really a monumental kind of change that that President Obama, you know, he actually announced it in December of 2014 that the United States was going to move towards establishing diplomatic relations. And just looking at that, what it's kind of insightful of how it had developed. It was really done with a whole series of secret meetings, apparently in Canada first, between the Cuban and American delegations that kind of set it up. And then it turns out that the that Pope Francis was also involved in it because he had had an interest in getting the United States and Cuba to recognize one another. So in some ways, this kind of opening is kind of instructive of how these kind of presidential visits and accomplishments can be undertaken. First, you have these kind of very quiet talks, secret negotiations. You have maybe interventions of third parties here. And then you have the sort of the public announcement the president can make. So this was really, it measures right up there in terms of the kind of change, much like we've been talking about in terms of the, in a sort of a different way, in terms of the Berlin Wall here, or even the opening of China, because it was again, a real turn in American foreign policy. Now, almost immediately when President Trump took office, he has pulled back, and even as recently as April here of this year, there has been more tightening of the kind of opening that President Obama had started here.
Mm-hmm. So this is really, with President Trump, really a departure, Tim Walz, with the way normally presidents of either party conduct these type of foreign visits. They want to have something in the bag.
Right. Right. I mean,
right?
Normally, the assumption is that you lay the groundwork because after the visit or at the time of the visit, you're going to come away with some sort of treaty or bilateral agreement or something, and you it's all scripted so that the actual meeting and the handshake is the formal end of the process. What you had in the case of President Obama is, of course, the beginning of what would be normalization of relations that would have led to further agreements. But once you change, first of all, you had a hostile Senate, who of course was not going to approve any kind of bilateral agreement with Cuba, and then there's just a sort of a pervasive hostility there between administrations, between the Obama administration and the Trump administration. So there's been a rollback and a resistance. I don't think what probably makes a difference is that the previous generation of Cuban Americans who fought Fidel Castro and remember 1961 and communism in Cuba are kind of passing from the scene. And it's their children and grandchildren who see the possibility of going back to Cuba and seeing their roots and their cousins and so forth is a compelling case for moving forward. So although there's some resistance on the part of the Trump administration to normalization of relations, the overwhelming pressure, I think, from within the American people are to eventually, in a de facto way, recognize our relations with Cuba. We're just too close. I mean, you can't ignore your neighbor forever.
When you put four...
What's made it more complicated, though, if I could just add, is that in the 1990s, there was some legislation passed that actually put the embargo into law. And so that means that the Congress has to act. Previously, you know, the sanctions that were put on were done largely by executive order, so a president could come in and lift them. But now with these kind of sanctions in law, that means, as Tim was saying, you got a hostile Senate here or a hostile Congress at all, it makes it more difficult to say, in that sense, lift the sanctions that have been in place for so long.
We have a couple minutes left in our conversation with Jim McCormick and Tim Walz as we wrap up our look at presidents and foreign visits in history. Let's do a little forward thinking here. I'm wondering what you gentlemen think with our age of increasingly sophisticated technology, video streaming available to practically everyone. Tim Walz, are personal visits becoming more or less important? I mean, we will soon be at the point where it's as if Princess Leia is holographed into the room. Do you need to be there personally when you can be holographed there?
It certainly has changed the relationship that we have in the military. It used to be, of course, you would write letters back and forth between your home and if you were in a war zone. Now, of course, they go to these specialized tents in Afghanistan or Iraq, and they have these, you know, Skype centers where you can see the kids and so forth. Should presidents and other world leaders communicate in that fashion? I suppose it's theoretically possible, and in fact, I'm sure they communicate on a regular basis, if not face-to-face. But I also think there's nothing quite like sitting across a table and working things out and taking the measure of another individual in the actual space.
Pumping the hand of that foreign leader.
And body language and so many other things.
It wouldn't create quite the photo op if you had one was a holograph or two were a holograph. Jim, what are your thoughts on the future of these type of presidential visits?
I agree very much. The personal nature of these visits, you know, taking the measure of the other individual, and, you know, particularly if there's some dispute that you've got to settle to get to that agreement, to having the personal interaction, I think really has the possibility of actually clinching the deal. So I think that the technology provides, you know, some increased level of communication, but really to complete the work, the personal touch is still consequential.
Right. The personal touch, it's about more than communication. It's also about symbolism.
Indeed.
As you both have illustrated so well this hour. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Tim Walsh, director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim and Jim, you team up well. Thank you very much for taking our hands and marching us back into history to learn some lessons here.
Thanks, Ben and Jim.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer and Caitlin Harrop. Also help today from Camus Leeson. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.